Margaret Haynes, and I'm currently the mayor pro tem for the city of Wilmington.
And Margaret Haynes, you are finishing your second four-year term. If you win this third term, you would be serving for 12 years on city council. Why do you want a third term?
Well, mainly because I'm pretty invested at this point in the process and so involved in a number of things. I think I represent a point of view of many people in the community, and right now I'm the only woman out of seven, and I think that in a way is different. You know, I have a great background for public service, and I enjoy doing it. Sort of a love-hate affair. Some days it's great, and then other days you think you want to pull your hair out. So, but overall, I enjoy it, and I feel like I'm making a contribution.
Well, give us an example of that. Tell us about something from the last 8 years that you've been really proud of.
Oh, goodness. There are a number of things. I think, you know, our number one thing is safety. That's the number one role of any government. And our safety record has improved year over year over year. And that's qualitative. We have statistics that show that. That's not just, you know, a story. and so I think that's very important. We've worked hard with the police department to move beyond sort of running a training school for policemen, and then they're hired away by other jurisdictions. So that's given us some continuity, and I think that's helped improve our record. So I'm certainly proud of that. I'm proud of the infrastructure improvements that we've made, and many of them are to improve the quality of life here. We've completed the Riverwalk, basically from bridge to bridge. It's almost 2 miles long. We have completed the initial Cross City Trail, which connects really all parts of the city. And now we can perhaps work on some spurs into other neighborhoods. And that's an effort to get people out of cars and not only to exercise and enjoy the outdoors, but to perhaps in some small way decrease the need for car traffic. Oh, gosh, there are just a number of things. The Convention Center Hotel, that was ongoing. That was one thing. Early on in my tenure, we had a contract with the Indigo. We extended. That never happened. We kept at it. And frankly, I just really held out for a full-service hotel. I think it's especially important when people come to conventions, I guess especially for women, that when you get there, you're not going to trek out on your own necessarily to find a bite to eat. You want to be in a hotel where they have a restaurant and you're safe, or where they have room service. So I think that's an important thing, and the Embassy Suites is there, and now the Convention Center is certainly performing above expectations. The Riverfront Park, that's almost a 7-acre park that we only paid $3 million for. Now, supposedly, something like that is selling for, you know, $1.5 to $2 million an acre. So that was a bargain, and we just happened to be in the right place at the right time. We had, we've had several bond issues that I'm proud of. One was transportation, and we've been working on that. And the other one was the parks bond, and that we're putting $10 million into the soccer complex, which is going to be fabulous. It's going to be a regional facility, and that is not only quality of life, but it's also economic development. And we're really getting into sports tourism, where people come, they're here for a long weekend, they're kids are out, everybody's having a great time, and then they leave. And so we don't have to provide schools and infrastructure like that.
And so you've been able to see some of these projects come to fruition during your tenure, like the Embassy Suites near the Convention Center. And then there are other projects like North Riverfront Park, which is now over budget and delayed. We thought it was going to open next year. Now it looks like it might open in 2021. What do you tell people about that and the shortfall there? And why are we over budget?
Well, it's just like any construction project. You know, the price of materials goes up. It's like everybody with the project after the hurricane almost a year ago, that people aren't available. It's much more competitive to get people, and the cost of building materials has skyrocketed. So, you know, we're no different than anyone else working on a project. In the city, once we design a project, then we do something that I hate called value engineering, and that's where we sort of cheapen down everything as much as we possibly can, and that's the process we're in now, is value engineering. It will open and it will be great when you have a project and it's designed and you have an estimate of what it cost, and then you send out your request for proposals, your RFPs, and the contractors come back and it's more than you had budgeted for. Then's when you have to start looking, and instead of granite, maybe you're going to put pavers, or instead of, I don't know, what, instead of wood around the stage, maybe you're going to use metal. So you have to then sort of step back and reassess where you can spend money and where you can save money.
There was a citizen survey that the city conducted this past spring, and 58% of residents who had an opinion said they were very satisfied or satisfied with the overall quality of city services, and most of that pointed to things like trash and recycling services and fire services. People were less satisfied with things like street and sidewalk repair and traffic flow management on city streets. Those are two very different things, but talk to us about the street and sidewalk repair and why that's so naughty for the city of Wilmington.
It's a difficult issue, and I agree. You know, I didn't fill that out, but I would certainly be in that group that's frustrated by the condition of the streets and the sidewalks. We do have a program that's getting funding, I believe some federal funding, which we've been working on for several years, called Sidewalks to Schools. And we're working on that over and over again in hopes of getting people again out of cars and onto bicycles or walking back and forth to school. The problem with the streets is also exacerbated by the storm. And so we're just going as quickly as we can. A lot of
that's talking about damage from Hurricane Florence.
Yeah, that the potholes, you know, the potholes, the rough thing, a lot of stormwater issues, culverts underneath collapse because they couldn't handle all of the water coming through for 3 days. So then the street above that collapses or sinks. And so there are just a lot of technical issues. Oftentimes the city staff, who are very good and work very hard, don't really have the capacity to repair something quite large. And then again, we always try to coordinate with the Cape Fear Public Utility Authority, so the street is only cut up one time. You know, traffic is just, if you've lived up north or you've lived in some metropolitan areas, it's not that terrible. That said, for those of us from North Carolina, it's pretty awful. And it's frustrating. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And that's why we're trying to do everything we can, big and small, to help people not have to drive across town. And that's another thing I'm really proud of.
So I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying here. To help with the traffic congestion issues, you are talking about getting people out of cars, number one, and initiatives for that. What else does that mean in a practical sense?
And getting people out of cars. The biggest thing we've done is in 2015, we started designing a comprehensive plan. And it took 2 years. We had a 25-member citizens committee. It was very diverse. It was not realtors and developers. The Riverkeeper was on it, a number of just regular city school teachers, a variety of people, young and old. It was racially diverse, age diverse, gender diverse, and they worked for 2 years, and they had over 18 neighborhood meetings. And think about that, over 18 neighborhood meetings, and you could go to any of them or all of them. You could go to anything you wanted to. It was heavily advertised. And what we really heard from people in that was that we understand 50,000 more people are coming here. And that's the job of council, is to plan for the future, to not look at the past so much except as a predictor of the future and what the needs of the future are.
And so what are you doing to
accommodate So in the comprehensive
that?
Plan, what we heard from people is, do what you will to the thoroughfares to make it better. Just stay out of my neighborhood. And we understand we're going to have more density within the city. We understand we're going to have more height within the city. If you need to do that on the thoroughfares, try to do it so that people live, work, and play on their side of town, and that every day they're not riding back and forth from Mayfair to downtown or to the Hanover Center or to wherever. And so that's what we have been doing, and those are the projects that we have approved, are mixed-use projects. And there are several mixed-use areas, plain mixed-use, urban mixed-use, Main Street mixed-use. So that all takes place in zoning.
Now, let's talk about opportunity zones, because there's at least one in Wilmington, that old site of the Wave Transit site, where there have been some fits and starts with what's going to happen there, and there's needed to be kind of a restart of the planning process for that, and even request for proposals, I think.
Yes.
And so what do you want to see happen with that site? What can we expect? Because some of the concerns around, I mean, opportunity zones can be complicated.
Very. But it's a federal program. It's very complicated. My understanding is there are 4 or 5 opportunity zones in Wilmington. Some are down near Greenfield Lake. Some are over near the college, and one is on that Castle Street
area. And this gets private investors. It gives them kind of a tax break.
Well, basically,
or a tax deferral.
Yeah, it's a huge tax break for investors. But you have to keep your money invested for a 10-year period of time. There's also a time frame on this that you only get 100% of the benefit if your project is approved and shovel-ready and all of that by December 31st of this year. Everybody's hoping that's extended, but it's a federal program, so we're not designing the program. Castle Street is so interesting, and we did send out a request for proposal to try to figure out what we wanted to do with it. What was the best use of the land? And we've talked with the stakeholders around there, and we have a real need here for workforce housing. And so that was in the request, that we would look favorably upon your request, more favorably, if you had some sense of how you were going to be able to provide some kind of workforce housing, housing that is affordable to people that are working. Now, the other element that I felt was important was to have some part of, it's a large site, to have some part of that site that serves that community, whether it's a community room, maybe have some kind of outdoor area that is a sort of a meeting place or whatever. And so Clark Hipp and some other folks have come forward. They are the only people that really submitted a proposal. And I think we've given him, the last meeting, we gave him an extension of 120 days. For me, and I've told Clark this, it all comes down to financing. Clark has a beautiful, he's an architect, he's creative, he has a great design, he has partnership with Habitat for Humanity that we know builds housing. They have a fabulous track record. He has other people involved, and he's looking for some of this investors for opportunity zones to pull that back. So the city, the buildings are in terrible.
This will be, when it moves forward, there will be some component of affordable housing here.
If this particular project moves forward, if Clark can pull it off, yes, it will.
And this is a concern that a lot of people have when you're talking about redeveloping a part of the city that has been economically depressed. Then there's this gentrification factor that always seems to happen and pushes out people who have historically lived there and who can no longer afford it. How do you manage that?
It's difficult. This particular project would increase the population in that area because it's not being hasn't been for many, many, many years used for any type of housing. So there, as you know, I assume, the city and the county have just gone together to establish an official housing, affordable housing organization. Five people from the city, five people from the county. The county has agreed to fund a full-time staff person to administer this concept of housing that is affordable, workforce housing. So I think we're making progress. It's slow, and it's difficult. And repurposing housing, you know, no house is turned over into being repurposed or used for something else that somebody isn't willing to sell it. So it's a difficult situation.
After Hurricane Florence, we learned that some of the city residents who were less affluent and did not have their own, say, private transportation, had no way of evacuating the city, were sort of trapped in their own homes. And I'm thinking specifically of the north side of Wilmington in the downtown area. And there was this kind of volunteer coalition led by Rachel Fox of Fox's Boxes, which is a little restaurant there. But they were finding people, elderly people, people who had disabilities, and people who did not have their own cars, who after days still didn't have power and had run out of food and had no way of going to some of these points of distribution and getting food or water, much less tarps. Is that something that's come across the city's radar in terms of storm response? And is this something that you're aware of?
I was somewhat aware of that. I think Rachel and Fox's Boxes is just an amazing community partner, and I can't say enough positive things about what they are doing. As you know, talking of transportation, for people that didn't have transportation that wanted to evacuate, Wave Transit, in conjunction with the city and the county, took a number of buses, and we made arrangements for people to be taken to Raleigh, I believe Durham, and as far away maybe as Winston. So there was a concerted effort and a very organized effort to take people that had no means of transportation but wanted to leave, to get them out of harm's way. So I think what you're talking about is people that stayed, then after the fact, it went on for so long that they were sort of without services,
right,
without nourishment and that type of thing.
And they may not have known also about some of those opportunities to get on the bus.
I guess that's possible, but, you know, there's a great effort made to reach out to these people through social services and a number of you know, the county is an extension of state government, and so they're responsible for the health department, social services, and all of that. So it's my understanding that there was quite an effort made on people's behalf to try to make sure that they were taken to a safe place if that's what they wanted.
Talk to us about climate change and sea level rise and what that means for city planning, because this is something that we've had discussions about here at WHQR with city planners and county planners and scientists. And one of the things that we've heard consistently is, yes, nuisance flooding will continue and it will become more frequent. And by that, I mean some people call it sunny day flooding, when Water Street, for example, in downtown Wilmington floods because of the tides and the phase of the moon. And then if we get a little extra rain, add that to the mix. Is this something that the city of Wilmington is seriously taking into consideration? And if they are, how?
Well, I'm not an urban planner, so, you know, that's not my training and that's not my background, although I have a master's of public administration degree, but that is not something we were dealing with. It's certainly true in floodplains you have to build to different standards, and I think now you have to get something like 14 feet out of the floodplain itself, or you have to provide some sort of provision like river suites down on the on Water Street. That's been there a very long time, and they have some flood mitigation gates that they have to shut. River Place, which is this new sort of transformational construction down on Water Street, they have to meet whatever the criteria is, it's going to happen. And what we need to do as a country is to recognize that this is a reality, that climate, believe me, your insurance company believes it. And, you know, the Chinese and other people in the world believe it. And so we as a government, a federal government, should start believing that and start doing things to try to mitigate the damage. But certainly there are rules and regulations, and you have to move back. It's not like we're on the ocean front. I mean, we have tidal waters, brackish water, you know, coming in from the river and the sea. So
do you see people, for example, on Water Street eventually moving up the hill and off Water Street? Is that what we're talking about?
Let's hope not. I mean, I think we are very lucky within the city limits that we have a very robust stormwater program. And so we are not like outside the city and in some other parts of North Carolina where when it rains and the rain comes down, there's nowhere for it to go. We have a very highly developed stormwater system. So while the water may rise, it also can go down very quickly. So let's hope that's not the case. I will say the city does have a lot of shoreline. The city itself, downtown, rests on a shoreline, as well as the intercoastal shoreline.
Going back to that survey that was conducted in the spring, one of the questions asked about the feelings over city communication, the availability of information about city services and programs, and 43% said they were happy with the availability of and the usefulness of the information on the city's website. Only 21% of people said they thought public involvement in decision-making was satisfactory. So that means a pretty large majority of people who filled out this survey said, while we're mostly satisfied with city services, we don't think we're as involved in decisions as we should be. Is there a way that city council or the city itself can engage more with the public? And how do you do that? Because from a city council person's point of view, it's got to get frustrating at some point. But on the other hand, what's your responsibility to your constituents when they have strong feelings about things?
I absolutely believe not only in transparency, but in participation. But 50% of that is on the part of the individual. That if you're interested, you have to pay attention to things, not just when it's your next door neighbor. And as I said, the comprehensive plan, 2 years, 18 neighborhood meetings, and then people generally never heard of it. So I don't know what more you can do. We're on social media, we're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We still print a paper newsletter. It's on government TV. I mean, I don't know what else you can really do. If people have specific ideas rather than just complaining, then, you know, great. Let's listen to them. We would love to hear it. I think we make every effort that we can to involve the stakeholders in any project. We would not do anything downtown without talking to the stakeholders. We wouldn't do anything out at Mayfair without having public hearings and community meetings. That's in our law. So we do it not only because we want to, but because it's a legal commitment that we've made.
I want to ask about the quality of the drinking water. And we certainly understand that there are regulators at the state level and the federal level that need to do their part. But there are plenty of people just in the city of Wilmington who want to know what their city council members can do to protect their drinking water supply.
Well, I can tell you that personally, I had an under-the-sink reverse osmosis system put in my house. Not everybody can do that. It's a very small, you know, just little thing that goes under the sink. I get that not everybody can do that.
So that can be between a $900 and $1,500 or $1,800 project.
Mine was $250. I had the guy hook it up to my refrigerator. So my ice is also filtered, and I think the total was $300. So
there are still a lot of citizens who wouldn't be able to afford
that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Would the city of Wilmington ever consider subsidizing those systems?
Not that I know of. I will say this. As you know, CFPUA is an authority. The city council has no control over them. But that said, we have been involved in trying to move this forward. You know, somebody somewhere along the line tried to get the Cape Fear River designated as a swamp so that these industries could dump more pollution into it. And fortunately, the current council heard about it, and this had happened apparently years and years ago, and we were able, through a lot of hard work and communication, to get that stopped through the EPA. A number of council members went last year to an annual meeting in Washington, and while we were there, our staff person had set up a meeting with the EPA. Even though that's a federal organization and we are a municipal organization, they were very generous, had a lot of staff people there, and they talked to us and gave us what their plan is for our area, for our state, and trying to deal with this and ameliorate it's not only Gen X, but it's all these other things. And didn't we just hear on the national news that water's full of plastic particles? I mean, this is really a frightening thing that has happened to our water, which is obviously everybody needs that just to basically sustain life. So we're aware of it. We're trying to deal with it as much as we possibly can. And for us, that's basically communicating with CFPUA and with the county and encouraging the EPA to move forward. And the State Department of Environmental Quality, Secretary Reagan, has been to Wilmington at the request of the mayor and city council, I think more than he ever thought he would be coming here. And we have sat and spoken with him a number of times. And I really do believe there, while there are limitations, people are trying. And there's a lot of finger pointing. You know, for me personally, I think Kemours ought to pay for the $1 million of improvements that need to be made. We're at the end of the line here, and we're getting all of this water coming down from more metropolitan areas, and they're polluting the water. To me, Kemours ought to pay.
Do you think the Confederate monuments that currently frame the entrance to the downtown area should remain there as they are? Why or why not?
Well, they don't frame the entire downtown area. Let's remember that the 1898 memorial is at the major entrance to the area from Highway, Interstate 40, as well as 421, as well as coming from the east. So you go several miles before you get to a Confederate monument. That said, the state of North Carolina has said that municipalities cannot remove them. So what, in talking and having a lot of stakeholder participation, the concept is to try to balance that out and to perhaps do some more things for the African-American community. If you think about it, we have the Martin Luther King byway. We have the Luther Jordan Bridge. We're going to have the Meadowlark Lemon Bridge. We've got the 1898 Memorial. And now we're going to designate 3rd Street. We're not going to change the name, but we're going to designate 3rd Street after Major General McNeil, who was one. I mean, he's an amazing guy, and that he was one of the four people that sat in at Woolworths in Greensboro and really changed the direction of this country.
We know that you support incentives for desirable industries. Just tell us how you would define desirable.
There are a variety of things that would go into the elements of desirable. There's no one thing. You know, people say, we want clean jobs. We want tech jobs. Well, yes, we do. And we have tech jobs, and we have young people with tech companies that are coming here because of the quality of life, and they can work anywhere. And that's quite wonderful. And they add to the fabric of our community. But we also have people here that need more blue-collar jobs. We have people here that need regular industrial jobs. So you have to look at what the balance is and try to see who's willing to come here and what they need. I want to make something really clear, and that's it. Incentives are really rebates. No one gets money up front to come here. We're not bribing someone to come here. What we're doing is, if you come here and you spend enormous amounts of money in building brick and mortar facilities and hiring so many people at so many jobs at such a pay level, then after that occurs and we're gaining tax revenue from that, we will rebate you a percentage of that.
Final question. Let's say you win the third term. You get a free pass for one project. You get to basically sign off on one thing that is absolutely going to happen the way you want it to happen. What's that one thing you want to make sure that finishes the way you want to see it finish?
Well, if it's something that's underway now, I would say the Riverfront Park is a real quality of life issue for us. I feel it's very important to provide a facility that is free, that is open to the public, and anybody, no matter what their financial resources are, can bring a blanket and have a picnic and enjoy the beautiful river and the light and the air and everything that's around you. So I think that's very important. It's always talked about as a music venue, but it's really also a family venue. It's a place for people to come and get out of the office and have lunch and to bring your kids for a birthday party and to whatever you want to do outside. And it's going to be a safe place with bathrooms, and it's going to be a real asset for our community. And I'm really looking forward to staying involved in that.
City of Wilmington Mayor Pro Tem Margaret Haynes, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.